one-on-one will share any pain. It's about newsmakers, movers and shakers, inspiration from around the nation. It's the 411 with Sharon Kay. What a way to make your day. Sharon Kay is on the way. It's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Inspiration from around the nation. It's the 411 with Sharon Kay. What a way to make a day. Sharon Kay is on the way.
Hi, this is Andrew Young from Atlanta, Georgia. And all over the country, no matter where I go, people are talking about what's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Oh, you so good to me. Hello, Nashville, all of our wonderful people. As always, we are totally glad and absolutely delighted that you found us today. So that you found us on a beautiful Wednesday, and it is a touch warmer. That to me is substantial, considering we froze to death yesterday, didn't we? You know, people had to actually put on a couple of layers. So it was interesting watching people really shiver.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's been a long time since people have shivered up like that hard in Nashville.
Yeah, that's true.
Seriously. But anyway, we are, you know, double the temperature today from yesterday to today. So all in favor, say aye. I think everybody's happy to see the change that came from one day to the next. Anyway, we have a lot in store for you today on the show. The news from the community, both this hour and next hour. And then my book discussion is on the need. Is there still a need for the Electoral College? So we'll have that. You know, for some people, they're like, well, it's kind of deep in the woods. Okay. Well, you know, these issues are pressing our nation. And the more you know, the better off you're going to be. Saving the Electoral College is our book. After we have to get our traffic report handled, and then we'll go into talking with the author. And he is a professor at... a professor of law, that is, at the University of Denver, Stern College of Law, and he teaches evidence and civil procedure as well as election law, and he is author of several books on this topic. Clearly, his latest is going to be, he'll be on tour with it, but he's an expert on the subject.
Yeah.
So we'll find out. The subtitle is Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. So I'm certain I'm going to be asking him some things about the Electoral College.
Yeah, for sure.
That may not be included in the book. Anyway, now, on the community news, I always like to, things that come across my desk or stuff I'm even involved in or participate in, I like to, you know, put some highlight on it. And in particular, there was, I had to be, had the privilege of being the MC today for the 20th year celebration of the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance. And it was really a blessing to see how those two communities merged, those two health institutions merged into having, you know, the health components that they do and the research that's conducted, etc. I remember when it started, 20 years ago, and one of the people at the forefront of that start was one of the guests that was at the luncheon today, and that is Dr. George C. Hill. He is well known to many in the health arena, chief diversity officer, pathology, microbiology, and immunology. Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, Molecular Physiology and Biophysics. He's a professor emeritus, the Levi Watkins Jr. Professor in Medical Education. So clearly, I was in the room with some tall cutting, y'all, all these health professionals with all this distinguished health people. And I said it, and I mean it. If I ever felt like I was going to fall out verklempt on the floor, this is a good room to do it in. With all the health providers in here, I know I'd be well taken care of. And Dr. Hill, it was a pleasure to meet you today and to see you, and I hope that you're doing well.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Wonderful, wonderful. Good afternoon. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. And it was a pleasure to meet you again at the celebration, the 20-year celebration of the Meharry-Vanderbilt Alliance.
Now,
a very auspicious time.
Oh, it was. And Dr. Hill, you were there at the very beginning when it first all got started, weren't you?
That's correct.
Heavily involved in, you know, the bringing together of the institutions for this alliance.
That's correct.
Can you talk about the early days for us for a minute?
Oh, certainly, be happy to. The beginning of the idea of the Meharry-Vanderbilt Alliance was a result of several things. President Maupin, who was there today, John Maupin, mm-hmm. and Vice Chancellor Harry Jacobson began to talk about how the two institutions could strengthen each other and really play a key role in our community. Another individual that was very much involved in it was the late Colleen Conway Welsh. In fact, Colleen, who was the dean of the School of Nursing at the time and for 25 years at Vanderbilt, mentioned to Dr. Jacobson that he needed to meet someone over at Meharry by the name of Dr. Maupin, who was the president. Mm-hmm. So I was at Meharry from 1983 to 2002. And then I moved from Meharry to Vanderbilt 2002 to when I retired a year ago.
Yeah.
And it was very clear when I was at Meharry that the leadership of the two institutions really wanted to take advantage of the talents of each institution.
Mm-hmm.
Meharry has a long history of training physicians, graduate scientists, graduate students, even nurses back in the day and dentists, and it has an excellent medical education track record. And Vanderbilt has an excellent record in research mm-hmm. and research achievement. So we saw the possibility of bringing the two institutions together to work from the strengths of each.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was clearly to identify ways in which these two institutions working together could help address the racial and ethnic health disparities that exist not only in Nashville but throughout the nation, throughout the world. And we wanted to make sure that this was a partnership that would allow that to happen. And so the leaders from the two institutions came together, and then the faculty came together, and they looked at projects and initiatives that we could work on together.
Mm-hmm.
But even before that, they learned a lot about the different institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Our cultures are different. Our missions are different. And by doing that, the faculty at the two institutions began to really learn about each other,
mm-hmm.
learn the common as well as differences that we had, but most importantly, learn about the excellence that each institution had.
Right.
And out of that grew a lot of different initiatives, whether they were in education or research
mm-hmm.
or clinical training, et cetera.
And Dr. Hill, I was just thinking back today when Dr. Maupin was, after he got an award and one of many awardees in that room, and he did talk about the difference from Nashville from 20-some years ago when this discussion was had, and Nashville of 20 years later. And I thought that was important for people to reflect on, because I'm sure that you all had some, I remember in the community, I've been behind this, I was behind this microphone at one of these stations, and remember this discussion, you know, a lot of people, you know, were scared and worried that, you know, Vanderbilt was going to try to take over. Can you talk about that time for us, please?
For sure. When the collaboration started, clearly there were individuals who felt, as I said, I was in Meharry at that time. Mm-hmm. There were individuals who felt that Meharry was going to be swallowed up by Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would no longer be Meharry. Maybe it would just be a part of Vanderbilt in a very formal sense. And Dr. Maupin and the other leaders of the institution took a lot of pains to make clear that no, that's not what we were talking about at all. Mm. We were talking about looking for partners with both institutions doing that so that the overall goals of each institution could be strengthened. So, yes, there were some individuals both in the community and at the institution, mm-hmm. at both institutions, particularly at Meharry, who felt that there might be an absorption of Meharry, if you will, into Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. And I know there were some Vanderbilt faculty who just felt that this was very risky for this quote-unquote prestigious University of Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that really worked well was how the individuals who were working on the initiative and then the faculty who were working on the different initiatives mm-hmm. recognized that there was mutual gain and they shared a mutual respect between the two institutions. So we ended up writing grants together, mm-hmm. training students together, doing clinical, providing clinical opportunities together, mm-hmm. such as in family medicine. Meharry has a family medicine department. Vanderbilt still doesn't have a family medicine department. Mm-hmm. So there was individuals at Vanderbilt training over at Meharry, mm-hmm. family medicine. There were individuals from Meharry who had the opportunity to do third-year and fourth-year clerkships in surgery mm-hmm. and pediatrics. It became and has become, because it continues, has become a very important way mm-hmm. to show that institutions from different backgrounds, different experiences, different pathways, different peoples can really be successful when they have that common goal. And the common goal was and still remains mm-hmm. how can we address racial and ethnic health disparities, mm. and how can we achieve health equity? There's one other point I'd like to make because uh-huh. I think it's important. There have been people in the community here in Nashville, and I think of Michelle Mars, who used to head the Community Health Center, Matthew Walker, mm-hmm. who's passed on. And today, Linda McClellan was present, mm-hmm. who has been very active in North Nashville and bringing communities together. I remember when we were working on a very important community initiative, a CDC initiative, that Ms. McClellan was one of the key individuals to help identify and bring together people in the community who would work with us in writing the grant and then benefit from the initiative. Mm-hmm. She was very, very helpful.
And also, too, culturally speaking, just thinking about the Nashville of 20 years ago, it was a different lay of this land culturally. And this merger or this development of this program, not a merger, don't want to use that word, Sharon.
Exactly.
The development, I had to pull that one back. The development of this program, the Alliance, it really did, to me, show mainstream of Nashville that it's okay to be over here on this side of town. And, you know, it's okay to have lunch with somebody black. And it's okay for black people to go across the Mason-Dixon West End. I mean, it was just really one of those kinds of deals. I remember when Dr. Hill, people used to say the Vanderbilt wanted to turn over here into the Vanderbilt of the North. I was like, oh.
Right.
So culturally, can you, and because you are a diversity officer and chancellor for diversity, equality, and inclusion in your career, you seem to me like the perfect person to be, in the mix at the beginning like that.
Well, you know, when David Satcher was president,
uh-huh.
and this was noted today, Mayor Bredesen was our mayor, and it became clear back in 1989, 1990, 1991 that Metro General was going to be modified, or a new building was going to occur over in East Nashville,
mm-hmm.
and Mayor Bredesen and Dr. Satcher worked very closely together to promote the idea
mm-hmm.
that instead of building a new hospital in East Nashville, Metro General could relocate to Meharry's campus at Hubbard Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you touched on a very important point, and that is when that idea was presented, there was a lot of discussion even on the council
mm-hmm.
and in Metro Hospital,
mm-hmm.
Metro General Hospital, that who in the world wants to create a situation where individuals would be coming to North Nashville for
mm-hmm.
health care? Mm-hmm. And both Dr. Satcher and Mayor Bredesen worked closely together
mm-hmm.
To bring that about. And in fact, as that was moving along, Vanderbilt chose not to staff the new Metro General over on Meharry's campus.
Mm.
So that created kind of an anxiety
mm-hmm.
and angst between the two institutions. And Dr. Satcher handled it so very well, and he remains a tremendous leader, and Phil Bredesen and the two of them just pulled it off, making mm. sure that, you know, there would be budget for it and that the support was there.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. In terms of community, that was a real challenge. And then fast forward to when Dr. Maupin, so Dr. Satcher went on to become head of CDC and then mm-hmm. Surgeon General,
mm-hmm.
and now is at Morehouse School of Medicine. Fast forward, and Dr. Jacobson and Dr. Maupin started mm-hmm. talking, and one thing became clear to Vanderbilt, and that is that the primary care training location that they had, they actually had given up when they decided not to work within Metro General in the relocated hospital. So this presented an opportunity for them to have an opportunity to have some training sites
mm-hmm.
At Meharry and in Metro General Hospital, particularly in primary care, as I mentioned. And it also provided an opportunity for Meharry faculty and students
mm-hmm.
begin to be involved in research over at Vanderbilt.
Mm.
So, yes, we went from a time when it was very tense to one where now these two leaders, I would say great leaders and leaders with a lot of foresight,
yes.
decided, yes, let's work together for the common good. And what was the common good? The community.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what we have to do when it comes to equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Absolutely.
We have to be open to listening to each other,
mm-hmm.
learning what we have in common, learning the differences and gaining from that. Then seeing now where can we work together to address some particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start talking with people, you find you have a lot more in common than you do have differences.
Definitely. Well, Dr. Hill, I'm just really tickled to death that you were able to be with me today because, you know, I think you just laid this out so well that, you know, everyone should be real clear on what that alliance has meant to for Nashville and in the yes. terms of our health. And celebrating their 20th anniversary, the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance. And Dr. Hill, thank you so much for your work and dedication.
Let me say one other thing because it goes along with what you just remarked. From the effort, a significant amount of research has been done. An institute called the Southern Community Cohort Study has started where we're going to be looking at the two institutions together.
Yes, sir.
80,000 African Americans and following them forever, basically, to look at what are the circumstances of their health,
uh-huh.
what are the circumstances that might cause disease. It's just a wonderful, wonderful initiative. And Dr. Jacobson summed it up today. He said, okay, we've gone 20 years, and this has been good. Let's see what the status is 30 years from now.
Uh-huh.
In other words, we just have to make sure that it continues with support from the both institutions.
Amen. Amen. Again, Dr. Hill, thank you so much. It's a privilege. And I know there were a lot of, I was impressed with the fact that you all had your community, had folks from the community who were, you know, some of your partners there and
yes.
community of faith and, you know, the business community as well as people who were participating in the luncheon just to show how far, you know, you all reached into the tentacles of Nashville. So I'm grateful to have met you and everyone today. And we just thank you so much for all the great things that you're doing.
Well, I think the leadership now at the Alliance with under Dr. Consuela Wilkins
yes.
and her team will continue to just do amazing things. She's a very thoughtful,
yes.
talented, dedicated physician. And it's going to continue to grow and develop. Thank
Absolutely.
You so very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. That was Dr. George C. Hill, Professor Emeritus and retired and just a distinguished man of health. And glad to have some of his time. That's invaluable information that he shared. And speaking of valuable, then what's more important right now than anything in Nashville, if you're getting off from work, is traffic. Oh, Lord, that'll run your pressure right through the top of your head. It truly will. Now, you laugh because you're in the business of traffic, Mr. Chuck.
I know. Job security, baby.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Nashville, you'll have a job till you're 99 years old. You know, this is something I just happened to discover this. Because you don't know about hot pockets in traffic until you are out sitting in them. You hear people talking about them. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know how hot a pocket, and I hope I never have to be over that way again. At that time of day, I was over by Vanderbilt and 21st and what is that, Broadway and all that. Man, that whole intersection, I went temporarily out of my head because I was like, I got discombobulated. I was like, where am I?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's changed. That whole area has changed so much that I was disoriented.
And that's at any time of the day, basically, over around the hospital.
Well, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, the mm-hmm. buildings and the way it looks, mm-hmm. the neighborhood. I was like, "What? I'm in another. I've been morphed to another city. I don't know where I am. I'm lost. Do I turn left here or do I turn right?" And you got to know where direction you're going in when you're sitting in that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For real. But
sure.
That's a hot pocket all the time in Charlotte and all that too, right, Chuck?
It is. It really is. I tell you what I'm looking at right now. It's got a hot pocket, and it's trying to get down into Brentwood, Sharon. It's a crash block in the left lane here, just shy of that exit ramp at OHB on 65 going southbound. Now, this is only going to get worse here in the next few minutes if they don't get this out of here on 65 southbound. Again, right before you get to Old Hickory Boulevard in the Brentwood area. Again, it's just before you get to that Brentwood exit there, OHB. Nolensville Pike at Wallace Road, that South Nashville popular intersection. There's been a crash there. Over in Bordeaux, there's a wreck. two cars, maybe three there at 3100 block at Clarksville Pike. Yes, it's busy on the south loop, the west loop. We've already had a crash headed up north in Madison there on 65 just before you get to Vietnam Vets. This traffic report brought to you by Prince's Hot Chicken. They're located at 5814 Nolensville Pike. I'm Commander Chuck. You're on time traffic.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Open enrollment season is here, and if you don't have a health care plan through a job or government program, it's time to get covered. From November 1st through December 15th, you can shop for a plan that starts on New Year's Day. Depending on your income, you might even qualify for financial assistance through a government subsidy. To learn more about open enrollment and compare health insurance policies for you and your family, visit insurancequotes.com.
Support for WFSK comes from Nashville General Hospital at Meharry. You should be at the center of your own health care, and we are here to help you. Call the Nashville Healthcare Center today and make an appointment with one of our primary care providers, 615-341-4488, or visit us on the web at nashvillehealthcarecenter.com. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty, Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance, also brought to you by Nashville General Hospital at Meharry. We thank you so very much for supporting What's the 411. And we have a new book today in this hour entitled Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. And I am going to introduce our guest and author to discuss his new book and get down to some contents in the book and ask some basic citizen questions. My guest is Robert M. Hardaway. He is professor of law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, where he teaches evidence and civil procedure and election law. He, of course, is author of numerous books and has written numerous articles. And Electoral College and election law are his specialties. So I know that you have already thought this thing through over and 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 over, because this is what you do. And knowing that this book is going to reveal some information that maybe we hadn't thought about, I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. And Professor Hardaway has also used his expertise on CNN, MSNBC, and numerous other stations. So, Professor Hardaway, how you doing today?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Thank you very much. Better than I deserve.
Well, you know, I think that you do. Maybe you do deserve some stuff, you know? Maybe you do. Now, where is the University of Denver? Is that that's the biggest university in the state, right?
Well, I would say University of Colorado is probably bigger in terms of the number of students.
Okay, okay.
But that's really not in Denver. That's out in Boulder, which is a little ways from here. But, yes, in Denver, I would say it's the biggest university in Denver, yes.
Okay. Well, I know it's beautiful there. Cold, but beautiful. Are you all experiencing snow now or what?
No, as a matter of fact, we're experiencing a little modest heat wave.
Wow.
It's temperatures in the 60s, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be 20 below zero tomorrow morning.
Right. That's true. That's true. Now, Professor, you've been there at that school for quite some time, right?
Yes, I'd be embarrassed to say for how long. I was a judge advocate. I've been a litigator, trial attorney. But I settled down here at the law school and enjoy teaching rather than having to listen to others control my situation. So, yes, I've been here for quite a while.
Okay, why did you hone in on the Electoral College?
Well, I first got interested in it when I was about 16 years old. I was going to a school in Washington, D.C., and we had a government class on Thursday nights, and we would invite members of Congress to talk about public issues, and we would divide up into two parties, and we would introduce bills and then debate them and vote on them. One of the ones that we discussed was the Electoral College. I was on one team, on one party, and then the other party was a fellow named Al Gore, who's perhaps you have heard of.
Oh, I think so.
He was a classmate of mine and also a very good middle linebacker on the St. Albans football team as well.
Hmm. So who won the debate?
Well, you know, I looked at my records, and I don't remember. Who outvoted who.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact vote.
I'm sure whoever tells the story is going to be the person that wins.
Yes.
You know. Yes, of course, you know, Al Gore, you know, you can't really be a real Tennessean. I'm not a native, but you can't be a Tennessean and not be familiar with that family name in politics. Now, since we have Electoral College discussions seem to been going on for such a long time.
About 200 years.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, well, they're talking about this now, but that's really not a new issue. So can you give us the background on why we have it? And then after you do that, was it based on trying to keep black people down because of slavery?
No, as a matter of fact, Vernon Jordan, who was head of the Urban League when they were debating this Electoral College question, testified in favor of keeping it because he said that if we get rid of the Electoral College, then we get rid of minority groups who are the critical margin of victory in many of the big states, and that it would be very, very disadvantageous to people of color. So, no, that wasn't the reason. What was the reason was that the country was basically breaking apart in 1787. Pennsylvania and New York were forming their own kind of country. They had built up tariffs. The small states were kind of going their own way. They didn't want to be marginalized by these huge big states. And so the Constitutional Convention was really a shot in the dark. Washington said it's not worth it going. We're never going to be able to form one solid union because the small states want a Congress or a legislature, which is based on equal state suffrage, equal suffrage. Every state gets a vote. And the big states said, no, we want to marginalize you small states. We're going to overwhelm you with our populations. And so at the very end, they kept that issue to the very end of the Constitutional Convention, and they couldn't agree. It looked like the country was breaking apart. If it had, we'd probably be five or six different countries now.
Mm-hmm.
The advisors to King George III were saying they're going to come back. That whole place is coming apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the last minute came the Grand Compromise. The Grand Compromise has, hey, small states, we'll give you equal suffrage in one house of the Congress, and we'll give the big states based on population. And so that was the Grand Compromise that brought the country together. And it's been the glue that has held the country together ever since then. As John F. Kennedy was the last one to really save the Electoral College, back in 1956 when he was in the Senate. Republicans were trying to get rid of the Electoral College. And JFK, in the manner of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, saved it because he pointed out something that people hadn't thought of. And that is that each state was given equal suffrage in the Senate, whether they were a large state or a small state, and the Electoral College was based on that equal suffrage in the Senate, because they got a electoral vote for every one they had, every senator they had, and also for how many people they had in the House. Mm-hmm. So you, and then a lot of people forget, they may have learned it in eighth grade civics class, but the last sentence of Article 5 says you cannot abolish equal suffrage in the Senate upon which the Electoral College is based unless every state agrees. You can't do it by constitutional amendment. And because of that, every attempt to undermine federalism has failed in the last 200 years once it's brought to their attention. You can't do it unless you first abolish, you can't abolish the Electoral College until you first abolish the U.S. Senate. Some people have said, well, on the mantra of one person, one vote, maybe we could keep the Senate and California would have 51 senators and Wyoming would be lucky to have one senator and so forth. But most of the people who advocate against the Electoral College, many of them say, well, we recognize we first have to get rid of the U.S. Senate.
Well, I mean, nowadays, that was personal. When you look at the Electoral College map, we have our state gets 11 votes here. But those people certainly do carry a lot of weight. And I'm not certain that, you know, as I see the things that they really represent. They represent, but they, I mean, sometimes I don't feel that the Electoral College, the votes, the folks who are in it, actually, I don't know if they're, aren't they supposed to be a little less partisan?
It's our Electoral College. They actually have one in the United Kingdom. They don't call it the Electoral College, of course. Mm-hmm. They call it Parliament, but it acts in the same way. Mm-hmm. You vote for a particular candidate for a particular party. Those then go into the Parliament, and then they select the leader. Now, the reasons that the drafters of the Constitution wanted to have a separate Electoral College from the legislature that passed laws was because of the separation of powers. They didn't want the legislature or the president to be beholden to the legislature, because that was contrary to their notion of separation of powers. And so we have a separate Electoral College. It's sort of a separate parliament that acts in the same way as the United Kingdom Parliament and all the other parliamentary democracies in the world.
Okay. So it doesn't, and you know, with this year's, from 2016 to now. And I'm grown. I've been around for a long time. And it just I've seen stuff. But it just seems like something needs to change. Because now that we are in the era of foreign meddling, like cyber, I don't even know if I'll ever trust a vote again. To be perfectly honest with you, as long as everything is done online or done digitally, I don't even know if I could trust that.
Well, I don't blame you in that. One of the greatest areas for fraud really is things like absentee ballot. It used to be that you had to get a doctor's excuse or something. And then all of a sudden somebody pulls out of the hat a whole bunch of so-called absentee ballots. So I'm with you there. But actually, France is a good example of why they're so upset, because they adopted the Russian system. Now, the Russian system is what many people propose for our system. They say we don't need an electoral college or a parliamentary democracy, anything like that. What we need is a so-called direct popular vote. Well, that's what they have in France. They had four candidates. The two major parties each got 19%. The extreme right-winger got 23%. And someone no one had ever heard of got 21%. Then they have a so-called runoff. where it's predetermined that someone is going to get over 50%, but the electorate was outraged by this Russian system, and 600,000 of the voters in France voted a blank, called the blank ballot, to express their outrage with the direct election of the Russian system. So we have been spared that catastrophe where you have 65% of the voters against the winner. And then that's what happened in France with their Russian system, their so-called popular vote system. They elected a candidate that was opposed by two-thirds of the electorate.
When we come back from the break, Professor Hardaway, I want to, because you are laying out the case, on page 32, I want to start there with electing a president. And, you know, you've been explaining why we need it. And when you're out here doing your book tour, there's probably a lot of people in the crowd who don't agree with you and think, you know, there's the opposite to what he's saying. But, of course, you're so studied on this topic, I don't know how well that argument could be won. But I do want you to talk about that particular section and then the grand compromise and the unit vote and the myths and misdirections in that particular chapter 6, okay?
I will be happy to do so.
Okay, today's book, Saving the Electoral College. Now, if you have a question or comment about the Electoral College and you want to know more, then that's why he's here, okay? Ask questions. You can do that at 615, or an opinion, 329-8810, 615-329-8810. Professor Robert M. Hardaway is here. Let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Are you over age 65? If so, it's time to get your ducks in a row about Medicare. Each fall, you have a chance to make changes to your Medicare coverage for the following year. But the clock is ticking. And this year, Medicare open enrollment only lasts from October 15th to December 7th. For more information on everything you need to know about Medicare and choosing your coverage plan, visit insurancequotes.com.
Support for WFSK comes from AEG Presents, award-winning contemporary jazz, R&B, and funk musician Brian Culbertson. Live in concert, Brian Culbertson is bringing the 2020 tour to Marathon Music Works on April 29th, 2020. Tickets and information available starting November 14th at marathonmusicworks.com and brianculbertson.com. That's brianculbertson.com. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty, Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And guest is Professor Robert M. Hardaway. He's a professor of law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law and is author of several books on the topic electoral college and electoral law. subject, Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. And you had said for 200 years people have been trying to undo it and wishing that things would be different and they would change. And you were just giving a little overview, a little bit, and probably sort of in one of your chapters, Electing a President, why an electoral college, and you've been kind of explaining all of that. And before we move out of that section and out of that chapter in general, did you ever think that we would have to be as concerned about some of the electoral issues that we are now? And did you, I mean, you've studied this work, and, you know, I don't know if I've ever, because I don't, I vote in every election. And I make that statement. I got all the stickers in here to prove it. But my point is that things are different, and you can, some people don't want to admit it. They think everything is fine, but there's something different and something that doesn't feel clean and pure about this whole process. So as somebody who's studied it and been in it and done it, what do you see?
Well, as I said, about every 10 years or so, when someone loses an election, they start talking about, quote, abolishing the Electoral College. But as John F. Kennedy noted in 1956, he disabused them of this possibility because he pointed out that the Constitution gives each state weight in the election of a president in the Electoral College. And you can't abrogate that or abolish it unless every state agrees, because the weight that each state has in the Electoral College is based on the number of senators they have in the Electoral College.
Right.
So if every state agrees, if, for example, Wyoming or Rhode Island says, we'll agree to abolish the Senate, if every state agrees to that, then the Electoral College would fail. But that's so unlikely that every state would give up the grand compromise that brought the country together when it was on the verge of splitting apart. It's been the glue that holds the country together.
So we'll always have the number of gerrymandering doesn't matter. And I mean, we'll always have the same number of senators. So that will always make the Electoral College stand.
Well, the Senate is the one thing you can't gerrymander, because every state gets two regardless.
Regardless.
So that kind of nullifies any attempts to gerrymandering, which is another reason that it's such an important part of the electoral process. There's the equal suffrage in the Senate.
Yeah.
The drafters of the Constitution were so adamant. They were afraid that every 10, 20 years, people would try to undermine federalism to abolish the Senate, and thus the Electoral College upon which it's based. That's why they put into the last sentence of Article 5, you cannot, by constitutional amendment, quote, abolish the Electoral College unless you abolish the U.S. Senate. And when JFK pointed this out to everybody, they said, well, is there a way around it? And that's how you get this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which I'd be happy to talk about too, which is a way around the Constitution and Article 5.
Okay, I want to talk about that, but I want you to do Chapter 6 first, the Grand Compromise and the unit vote and the myths and misdirections. And then we'll go into that organization talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as JFK noted, the reason that we have adopted an electoral college as sort of a parliamentary system instead of the Russian system of so-called direct election is because the Russian system would greatly increase the likelihood of a minority president. It would break down the federal system under which the states entered the union, which provides a system of checks and balances that ensure that, this is quoting from John F. Kennedy, no area or group shall obtain too much power. He said a country is not sustainable, as big as the United States is geographically, when you just have a few enclaves on the coast trying to rule the whole country. And the drafters broad, not just deep. For example, in the 1950s, you might have had a 90% vote for a segregationist candidate, and maybe that would result in an overall popular vote for a candidate. Mm-hmm. But it's the Electoral College ensures that if the rest of the country, two-thirds of the other three-quarters of the country oppose that candidate, can't be elected. So you need support that just isn't deep in one area, like on the coast, but broad support across the entire country.
Hmm. So knowing that is the case, you lay that case out in this book, and you've been studying this all this time. Why isn't anybody taking notice or heed, to the research and work that you all do what you do are doing? Why?
Well, most people haven't learned about the Electoral College in high school or even in grade school. They don't know about the last sentence of Article 5. They don't know the weight that each state gets in the presidential elections is based on equal suffrage in the Senate, which cannot be abrogated except by the universal approval of every state. And so there's a lot of confusion. The biggest confusion, perhaps, is when they go in the voting booth and they think they're voting for a candidate. They think they're voting for Trump or they're voting for Hillary Clinton, and they're not. They're not. There's no popular vote right now. Mm-hmm. You vote for, just like you do in England when you vote for a member of parliament, you're voting for someone who says, if you elect me, I will go to the Electoral College or in England, the parliament, and vote for a particular candidate. And there is no popular vote. It is a vote for a person who will represent your interests. And that's why most states say that the electors are required by law to reflect the popular vote of the people in that state. Hmm. And that's been the rule since 1876. Colorado was actually the last state to say, no, we're going to require our electors to submit to election by the people, and the people will then, and we'll pass a law that says that the electors have to reflect the will of the people. And as John F. Kennedy said, this formula that the drafters gave us gives big states an advantage. A state like California can give something like 50-some electoral votes to their candidate and not allow the opposing party any votes. That's their advantage. The small states have a small advantage that is guaranteed by the Constitution, which is they are guaranteed a minimum of 3 electoral votes, 2 based on the Senate and at least 1 in the House.
Okay. X, what did you want to say?
Yeah, he's got me thinking. So we live here in Tennessee, so I sort of feel like, I'm not saying this to be true, but does it matter if we go out and vote for in 2020 who's at the top of the ticket in the presidency, if it's not going to matter?
You don't vote for a candidate. You're voting for someone who says, if you vote for me, I'm an elector. You're not voting for a candidate. But you're voting for an elector who says, if you vote for me, I promise under oath that I will go to the Electoral College and vote for the candidate that you want me to vote for. That's who you're voting for. And in only a handful of cases in the last 200 years has anyone tried to violate that oath. And in most states, you can't violate the oath.
Okay.
It's against the law.
So how do electors become electors?
They're appointed by their party. For example, in the Democratic Party, they say, let's put up a slate of electors who promise that if they're elected, that slate is elected, they will go to the Electoral College and vote for Hillary Clinton, which they did, except in 2016, one elector said, I don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. And so now there's a case being appealed, which I'm writing a brief for. The question is, can you force them? And Colorado has a law which says, yes, you have to vote for the person that you promised to vote for. But you're not voting for a candidate when you go into the voting booth. You're voting for an electoral slate, just like you do in England and all the parliamentary democracies.
Right. And how often has that happened where that person did and said they didn't want it to, they changed their mind and didn't
want to? It's a handful of times, and only in states which do not require it. Some states don't require it because they say, well, it's never affected an election. Colorado, though, and most states have a law that says you have to vote for the person you promised to vote for. It's only happened a few times, and it's never made a difference in an election. But I think every state should pass laws requiring the electors to vote to reflect the will of the people who elected them.
Well, I think I agree with that. I think that's true. Now, what is the organization, I believe California-based organization, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, that is being proposed. It's already in some states now, about a dozen or so.
Yeah. Well, most of my book is addressed to that. The biggest problem with the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, mm-hmm. is, as people know, it's where the state would say, well, we won't care what the votes are in our state. We'll look at what the votes are in other states, mm-hmm. for various electoral slates. Mm-hmm. And then we'll defer to the other states and vote for the so-called national popular vote winner. But the problem with that is there is no such thing as a popular vote. Mm-hmm. You vote for electors. In the 1960 election, for example, the electors were not pledged to anybody. Mm-hmm. And you had hundreds of thousands of voters voting for electors who said, we're not pledged to anybody. And how do you count the popular votes for electors who are not pledged to anybody? There's no way to do it. And if you ask the NPVIC people, how would you count those votes for those unpledged electors? They say, we'd simply disenfranchise the millions of voters who voted for those electors. Mm-hmm. And disenfranchisement and nullifying the votes of votes in the people of the people in the state is not my idea of democracy.
Now, in Chapter 10, you go into the myths about the Electoral College. And, you know, if you do a search, you'll see pros and cons galore on the Internet for those that live there and use that for their sole source. What may the reader find in your book?
Well, the problem is, it's one thing to say, would it be good if every state agreed to abolish the U.S. Senate, upon which the Electoral College is based, which, mm-hmm. of course, would also abolish the Electoral College. The first question is, can you do it? And yes, you can, if all 50 states agree. If Rhode Island says, we'll give up our two senators in the Senate, and Wyoming does too, mm-hmm. That's possible. So the next question is, if it were possible, I don't think it is. But if it were possible that every state gives up its weight that's guaranteed to them in the Constitution and the presidential election, if every state were to agree to give up that right, would it be a good idea? And I list in my chapters all the reasons why it would be a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. For one thing, if we had had a Russian-style popular vote in 1960, we still wouldn't know who the president was, because you'd have to recount 114,000 different Hamlets. We thought that things were kind of traumatic back in 2000 when you had to recount in one state, mm-hmm. Florida, and you saw what happened there with the appeals and so on, and the mm-hmm. and the discombobulation of a country.
Right.
Imagine doing that in all 50 states separately, mm-hmm. especially when different states have different thresholds for recounts. Mm-hmm. And so you can't really have a total recount. Mm-hmm. So it's a monster. The whole idea is so monstrous that even to contemplate a Russian system, right. that threw France into outrage,
because
right. that's what results. You get a minority president, somebody's only supported by about 30% of the voters.
Yeah.
It's terrible to contemplate, really.
Well, and Professor Hardaway, can an elector get bribed or get, decide that I'd rather get paid off or what? I mean, is there what protection do we have against that?
Well, there's a few states, there are some states which have not yet passed laws which require that an elector vote for the person they promised to vote for. Mm-hmm. As I've said, I would suggest that those states go ahead, like Colorado and most right. other states, and pass a law. Like in Colorado, if you don't vote for the person that you promised to vote for, you have just declared yourself ineligible to be an elector under Colorado law, mm-hmm. and you're replaced by someone who agrees to vote for the person who they promised to vote for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in Colorado, 148,000 people voted for the elector slate for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. One decided, I don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, but there's a law. And so the judge said, well, I'm going to replace you, because otherwise you're disenfranchising right. 148,000 people,
right.
which to me is outrageous.
Right. So do you think bribery or money could take... could seep in, because...
In Colorado, they just replace you. If you don't vote for the person that you promised to vote for, you've just said to you, you've just announced a big sign on your thing, I haven't abided by the requirements to be an elector, because the requirements are for an elector is that you will vote for the person who you promised to vote for in the Electoral College.
Yeah.
You can bribe them all you want in Colorado, but you'll just be replaced. so the bribery wouldn't do any good.
Well, that sure seems like it should go across the board with everybody, you know, all the states, because that would at least...
Well, the reason they haven't is because the number of times when electors have broken their pledge has been so few.
Okay.
It's just a relative handful. It's never affected an election, so some states get complacent.
Okay.
But the problem is that occasionally, like electoral votes close. Usually, the electoral vote is not very close.
Yeah.
And so, if you have an elector in a state which has not passed such a law providing for replacement of an elector who violates his pledge and thus disqualifies himself as an elector, there could be a constitutional problem. So I would suggest that the few remaining states which don't have a requirement that the elector vote for the person they promised to vote for should change their laws.
And lastly, do you think this, as we go to the top of the hour, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact with the number of states that they have signed up now, do you see that having an impact on 2020?
I don't see how it can, because it's based on a fallacy. It's based on an illusion. They're relying on the illusion that people get when they watch TV and when they go in the voting booth. See at the bottom of the screen so many, quote, popular votes for a candidate.
Right.
But they're not votes for a candidate. There is no popular vote that the NPVIC people can rely on as the basis for a nationwide Russian-style popular vote.
Mm.
And they don't even have pledged electors. They're just electors on a Democratic slate or Republican slate, but they haven't promised to vote for anybody. So how would you count these so-called popular votes for unpledged electors? NPVICs will ignore the millions of people who voted for them.
Mm. Wow.
And I find that intolerable.
Yeah, really.
And undemocratic, not to mention unconstitutional.
Right. The name of the book is Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. University of Denver professor Robert M. I'm looking for your middle initial. Robert M. Hardaway is the author and my guest. And to find out more about your work, and I know you've written other books and things of that nature, what's the best place, and to find the new one, what's the best place?
Well, I think the new book is Saving the Electoral College. It doesn't really need saving because I don't believe 50 states are going to give up the Senate or abolish the Senate upon which the Electoral College is based. So I don't. That's a title that I think that my publisher came up with because they don't understand it either. But I, Amazon, of course, and order the book. I think most places you can on Amazon you can order the book. There's also a website called that I'm associated with called Saving the States.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that we're going to abolish states. For purposes of presidential elections, which is the way they sort of do it in France and in Russia, which is to save the states. As Madison said, quoting Madison, the JFK, when he saved the Electoral College back in 1956, Madison said, the government is not completely consolidated, nor is it entirely federal.
Hmm.
Who are the parties to it? The people. Not the people comprising one giant mass, but the people comprising 13 sovereignties. We have federalism. It's known as federalism. And those who want to undercut our federalist system of government and go to the Russian system are, of course, in favor of abolishing the U.S. Senate and, of course, the Electoral College, upon which and the Senate and the Electoral College, which is based on representation in the Senate.
Robert,
which cannot be abrogated unless every state agrees.
Professor Robert M. Hardaway, Professor of Law at the University of Denver, Sturm College of Law, thank you so much for being with us, and I hope that you have a good rest of the day, okay?
Thank you very much and for having me on and giving out the word.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And thank you for his time. Let's get our news and come back on the other side with... we have another new book and author to get to and some community news as well. But first, let's take this quick time out.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.